morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever and whenever you may be, and welcome to episode 140 of the Fade to Black podcast. I'm Hannah Flint.
I'm Clarice Lockery.
And I'm Amon Warman, or rather, I'm a recording of Amon Warman, because as Clarice and Hannah record this podcast episode, I am in the air flying towards Melbourne for my holiday. So I leave you in the very capable hands of Hannah and Clarice. But before I do, I just want to say a couple of things. One, one of the films I'm going to be discussing today is Rebel Moon. Not a fan of that film. It was really bad. I'm sure Hannah and Clarice will tell you why. Two, thank you so much for taking a chance on Fade to Black and pressing play on our podcast. We all really appreciate it. We appreciate you hanging out with us, whether it's your first episode or your 100th episode. We do not take that for granted. And we love doing what we do, and we're going to continue to do what we do in 2024 and beyond. So please join us again when the new year comes around. Until that time, have a great Christmas. Have a great New Year's. Thanks. Bye.
Let's get into what's happening. This week, Amon speaks to Lee Child about bringing his creation back to the small screen for Reacher Season 2. And Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget director Sam Fell about the return of Aardman Animation's Pluckiest Fowls. Meanwhile, we travel to a galaxy far, far away for Zack Snyder's Rebel Moon Part 1, A Child of Fire, the concert hall for Bradley Cooper's Maestro, and the shores of Japan for Hayao Miyazaki's The Boy and the Heron and Takashi Yamazaki's Godzilla Minus One. Plus, in our hot take, we talk the best non-Christmas movies to watch at Christmas. So yeah, it's just me and you. It's me and you.
Yeah.
Please, girl squad, girl gang.
Girl squad talking about Maestro.
Yeah.
The girls love to talk about Maestro, I've heard, on the streets.
Yeah. All the gorgeous gals. All the gorgeous gals chat about Maestro. Have you been gorgeous galling this week? Where have you been gorgeous galling?
Oh, I guess I did. I met Willem Dafoe and Mark Ruffalo yesterday. And Rami Youssef. So I did the Poor Things junket. And I think I now have two more parasocial father figures. I, of course, told Willem and Mark how much I relate to Bella Baxter. We'll get into that, I'm sure, when we talk about the movie. And, like, by the end of the 5 minutes, they were basically cool. They were like, go on, Bella, go live life. And then I was walking down the corridor leaving, and Willem Dafoe was coming up with his little cup of tea. And he went, there's Bella. And I felt very treasured. That was a very treasured moment.
I love that. Do you think he's calling all the girlies Bella?
Oh, I would hope not. I hope
Slutty
it's special
daddy.
Just for me. Yeah. But I've never interviewed Willem Dafoe before, and he really is like, I feel like he could be a trickster god. Like, there's something so he really has a presence, and it's so there's something a bit mischievous about it, and I feel like he could say something really profound and then disappear in a puff of smoke, and I'd be like there goes Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, yeah. He gives like very traditional, he's like a puck, you know?
That yesterday. He's so puck. Yeah, Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I'm going to toil with the humans.
Yeah, I'm going to fuck with them too.
Yeah.
And then leave.
And like bells also, ring.
You know who he'd also be very good at doing? He'd be very good at playing the Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, any sort of, which he hasn't, I'm trying to think, he hasn't really played a lot of characters like that. But yeah, like the trickster, the mythical trickster figure, he just has that energy. And I mean that in the biggest complimentary way, because I love a trickster god.
God,
it's one of my favorite types
if...
of gods.
I like those tricky sons of a bitches. It's what we need Robert Eggers to do. I think we need, because he's doing, Robert Eggers is doing Nosferatu next.
Yes.
Right? But like, he needs to do like, I'd love to see his Midsummer Night's Dream, because it would actually be a Midsummer Nightmare. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Yes. And it would be so historically accurate.
Yeah. Historically accurate to fairies.
Yeah, but you know he'd find a period to set it in and then he'd stick to it, because it seems to be what he's doing with Nosferatu.
It's Greece, isn't it? It's Greece, it's Athens, and it's because it's at the core of Theseus, isn't it?
Yeah. So I feel like we could go ancient Greece vibes.
This is what happens when Amon's not on the show. We just get really mythological. That's what you're in for. Forget any of the reviews. It's just us.
That's what Zack Snyder wants, because he's writing his own mythology. So really, it's actually incredibly relevant.
So before we get into our review section, here's our first interview with Amon. But the trailer first for Reacher Season 2.
Been carjacked, right? Don't turn around. This won't take long.
Wait! Who are you?
Someone who prefers not getting involved.
Reacher for the stars. Punch all those bad guys now. Oh, Reacher for the stars. Oh yes, we're talking about season 2 of Reacher. When a member of his former US Army unit is murdered, Reacher, played once again by Alan Ritchson, reunites with three of his ex-teammates to investigate. This series is showrun by Nick Santora and stars Alan Ritchson, Maria Sten, Surinder Swan, Robert Patrick, and Sean Sipos. So yeah, I spoke to the creator of Reacher and the executive producer of the show, Lee Child. It was a real honor to get to sit down with him. I'm a big fan of this character he's created, and I really enjoyed season 1 of this show. I think season 2 is even better. I had an absolute blast with it, and this chat was a lot of fun. We got into how it feels to let go of Reacher and have someone else come in and add their own things to it. He talked a bit about how he likes to put himself or a bit of himself into the character of Reacher, and I asked him if there was any reciprocity with that. That was a question that got some interesting answers, and there was a lot of interesting answers dotted all around this 20-minute chat, which you are about to listen to. So here it is, me, Lee Child, talking Reacher. Enjoy. Welcome to the Fate of Black podcast. Lee Child, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you doing, Eamon?
I'm doing really well. All the better for having watched Reacher season 2. I really enjoyed season 1. I like this one even better. I had a really good time. So congratulations.
Thanks.
The first season was, of course, adapting Killing Floor. Why was this the right story to tell for season 2?
Well, if you think back to season 1 with Killing Floor, that the way they did it was to... That was right after Reacher left the army. So in a sense, Reacher was learning to be the new Reacher with his new lifestyle. And we included an awful lot of backstory about his mom, his dad, his brother, his childhood. It was really, of course, in itself, it was a great action season with lots of mystery and tension and action and so on. But it was really establishing who Reacher was as a person. And so for the second season, we wanted the same thing. Action, of course, a great story, but we wanted to try and define who Reacher was professionally. So we chose one of the books where that features Reacher's old elite unit, the 110th MP, the special investigators. That was the heart and soul of his military service, really. So that second season is really about defining him professionally, because, you know, sadly, there are people who haven't read the books who will watch the television. And so we've got to bear in mind that there are people going to be watching who don't know who Reacher is yet. So between season 1 and season 2, I think we've defined for those people who Reacher is, so that for subsequent seasons, we're up and running. They know the situation. And then we get a lot of freedom to just tell the story.
Yeah, I like that. You're someone who, I guess, has had multiple experience with this now, but this is going from it being in your head to being on the screen. How have you found that process, especially on season one of this show? And obviously you had the films beforehand, but season one of Reacher, was that a bit of a trip, or have you gotten sort of used to it now in terms of what's been in your head, and how similar or different is it to what you originally envisioned?
It's not an unusual feeling, because the whole thing about writing a book is you actually want somebody to take it from you. You want somebody to adopt the character in their own head and in their own lives. And so the idea that it then goes to the screen is not a huge leap, because you're already used to it being possessed by somebody else. What's really freaky about it is that when you write in the book, especially with a strong repeating character like Reacher, inevitably you put a lot of yourself into the character. I don't think there's any other way of writing fiction without making it a bit autobiographical. And some of it, of course, is like an in-joke for me. Reacher and I have the same birthday. We both like similar stuff. And so I've written it, and the screenwriter then produces the screenplay, and the actors and the directors then interpret the screenplay. And so I'm watching them feed myself back to me in a certain way. And that is really interesting. You know, what are they picking up on? What do they think is important? What do they emphasize? What do they de-emphasize? So, yeah, it's a really fascinating process.
Wow. I love that. You mentioned a little bit about putting yourself into the character. I want to talk about putting yourself into the show, because I know that you had a cameo in season one. How often were you on set for season two? And is there a cameo in season two that people should be looking out for?
Well, I was on the set as much as was possible. But the thing about season one and season two is that there were still a lot of COVID restrictions, because I don't think anybody was seriously worried about getting sick, really. But the problem was that if for some reason production is interrupted, then it throws the whole schedule out. It costs millions of dollars and delays and all that kind of thing. So they were very, very precise about COVID precautions, which meant that I couldn't just breeze in and out when I felt like it. You know, it had to be set up, and you had to test to get in. I remember my first few visits, I must have had like 100 tests in a week or something like that, because they were taking it that seriously.
Wow.
So I didn't go as much as I wanted to, but I did go up for season two, ready for my cameo. But we were suddenly hit by the worst possible weather. It was this Arctic blast. It was 50 degrees below zero. And production was still carrying on, but it was really, really slowed down. And so we did not get to my scene in time. Ugh. So, yeah, the tragic truth is I'm not in season two, but hopefully we'll get better weather for future seasons, and I'll be able to resume my habit.
Amen. That's what we're really tuning in for. I want to see the Leechard cameo. I need that in season three and beyond. With Reacher, with this season especially, I've really liked the people that you've surrounded him with, because he is often the brawniest and the smartest guy in the room. Here in this season especially, he's surrounded by a lot of other smart people. Can you talk about that ensemble and what that helps bring out in Reacher?
I'm glad you said that, because I agree that it was a strange balance in season two, because Reacher is a guy who loves his solitude and he loves just being left alone. But because of various bad circumstances, he's back together with his old unit. And these are people that he really loves and he really trusts. And they've been in life and death situations together. They're very important to him, which introduced a slightly different element, because Reacher's totally self-confident, except possibly in front of these people. He's made choices in his life which look eccentric. He's just a wanderer, whereas his other friends have become careers. You know, they've got new jobs and started corporate security and all that kind of thing. And so for the first time in his life, Reacher's a little bit unsure. Did he make the right choice? what are his close friends going to think of him when they see him again after all those years? Mm-hmm. They're all smart. You know, they're working in the corporate world. They've got technology. They're wearing suits and all that kind of thing. And there's Reacher, who's basically a bum. What are they going to think of him? Now, normally he doesn't care about that. But this time, yes, he does. He cares a little bit. What do they think of him? Do they think he's an idiot or not? Mm-hmm. And so it gives it that slight element of extra in it that I was really interested in. You know what it's like? You always, if you got close friends, it does matter to you what they think of you. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, Reacher is suffering from that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. I also love, you know, I'm someone who's been known to say this quite a bit, but there are a few things that I enjoy watching more on screen than good leadership. And Reacher definitely fits the bill on that. The leadership and the loyalty his friends have to him, the way in which that comes across is so powerful to me. I wonder if you could talk about writing that element of the character and how that element is translated to screen, because I think they did a great job of that.
Yeah, I think they did a great job too. And I think it's certainly important to me. I mean, I'm a loyal person. And if you're my friend, then you're my friend for life. And I will do whatever I can for you. And you're probably the same. But it's a small group of people that you feel that way with. Mm-hmm. And when you're with them, with the people like that, he found leadership quite difficult. Because as you say, they are all smart, tough people. Do they really need leadership? Mm-hmm. But somebody's got to be the leader. And he was back in the old days. Mm-hmm. And now they've got back together in unofficial circumstances of great danger. And they kind of make him the leader again. And I think that he's a little uneasy about that. What is no longer inside the military structure. So why should he be the leader? So there's a little uncertainty there, too. And the way they did that on the screen, I think they did it with sort of flashbacks. I think we saw them in the current day thrown together. Then we saw the history of their previous relationship when they were in the military. And you can see his leadership evolve. Mm-hmm. Because what I was trying to do here is, you know, obviously the military is a very specific thing, but it's really also quite a general thing. Virtually everybody has a job that involves some kind of hierarchy. And there's always idiots in the hierarchy somewhere screwing everything up and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And everybody understands that, whatever their job is. So what we tried to do was portray that where it's them against the world. They're in this tight little unit. And they're going to be sticking together, loyal to each other against the rest of the organization. Mm-hmm. And they achieved that through flashbacks to when they were serving together. Yeah. And I think that worked really well.
Yeah, I do too. There's a recurring line in this season, particularly in an investigation details matter, which always makes me chuckle every time I hear it. What are your favorite little details in season two? I have a couple, but I want to throw it out to you first.
Oh, my. What are my favorite little details? Well, there's a bad guy who is completely mysterious at first. Mm-hmm. He's got a lot of different identities available to him, but they all begin with the same initials. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was important. It was a kind of dumb move on his part, actually, because using the same initials kind of tips your hand a little bit, mm-hmm. and it makes him slightly easier to find, perhaps. But what about you? What were your favorite details?
Well, there's one. I'm intrigued to hear your reaction to this. I think Alan Ritson is incredible in the role. The way in which Reacher wears a suit always makes me laugh. Like, I don't is he buying one size too small on purpose? Because it just feels always so tight, no matter how big it is, because he's so large. And then when he tries to run, he's a really big dude, but it just looks a little bit ridiculous in a fun way, which I kind of like.
Yeah, so, me too. And they picked that up from the books where, you know, many times Reacher says he hates running and he never runs because unless he has to, because, a big guy like that finds it difficult. Mm-hmm. And it's a good point about the suits. I mean, that probably is a costume designer decision to emphasize how huge the guy is, that there isn't a suit big enough for him. But yeah, he looks terrible in a suit. He looks really uncomfortable. And I don't know whether that's true of Alan himself, You know, normally when I see him, he's just dressed like a regular person. I'll take a note. If he looks good in a suit, I'll ask him what size he's wearing, and then I'll find out what size they give him for the show.
Please do. I want to know that information for sure. But you touched on it a little bit a few minutes ago. I want to follow up on it because it's interesting in terms of the mystery of the story and what details to give away at certain points. As you're writing that, what's your process in writing that? Because you want to craft a mystery that is befitting of the skill set of a Reacher, and also not just Reacher, he's got this whole unit. As you say, a very smart people. And you need to have that be a believable enough mystery that they won't get it immediately and it has to unspool over a certain amount of episodes. How do you go about doing that in a convincing way that gives the villain his smarts, but also doesn't hurt the smarts of the heroes that who are chasing them now?
Well, I do it with a very simple way of doing it, which sounds crazy for a writer. But I don't know what the mystery is at the time I'm writing it. I'm working it out page by page along with Reacher and his colleagues. Mm. So it's not a question of knowing, okay, this is happening, and so I've got to work my way up to it. Mm. It's like, what on earth is going on here? I do not know. I literally don't know while I'm writing the book. I just have the bad guy doing various things, and then the good guys have to figure it out as they go along. And that makes it very authentic because they are literally discovering it. I'm discovering it as I go along.
I love that. You touched on it a little bit earlier, but I wanted to follow up on this as well. Other people adding to your initial vision and initial blueprint of the character. Obviously, you've had a couple of films. You've now had a couple of seasons of this show and a whole lot of people involved in both of those. You also had your brother come in to do a couple books as well. What's that been like for you? Have you gotten better at sort of letting go and letting other people do their thing? And has there been any particular addition that you almost wish you thought of yourself that somebody else has come up with and added to each other?
There's been quite a few of those. Yeah, you know, where they've read the book, they've really thought about it, they've produce a screenplay that does turn out certain aspects better than I would have been able to do it myself. Mm. So, yeah, the letting go thing is actually opposite from what most people think. They think it must be difficult to let it go. But really, that's what you're planning from the very, very beginning. You want the reader, when you're just a book writer, you want the reader to own that character. You want the reader to have that character living in his head. And immediately you're giving it away. As soon as you've got a decent number of readers, it belongs to them, not me anymore. So you've already given it away. And they all have their own opinions. I describe Reacher a little bit in the book series, not in any great detail, but in a little bit. But even so, some readers swear that he has black hair. Some readers swear that he has blonde hair. It's their own picture. They now own the character. So giving him to movies or giving him to television and ultimately giving him to my brother is only a continuation of a process that started years and years ago. As soon as there was a significant number of readers, you've already given it away.
That's fascinating. Has any of the media, any of the films and TV shows that have come since you've done these books impacted what is in your mind and what you envision when you then sit back down to write another Reacher novel? Like, do you picture Alan Ritchson's head voice in your brain now that he's Reacher, or is it something else for you?
Well, you know, it was in a way good luck, in a way bad luck. It was a long time before Reacher ever hit the screen with a physical person playing him. Mm-hmm. And so by that point, I was totally secure as to who Reacher was, what he looked like. Mm-hmm. And so the other people's depictions, first of all, Tom Cruise, now Alan Ritchson, they do not change the way that I picture Reacher at all. Maybe it would have if it had happened very, very soon after the first book. But given the time lag, no, I'm totally solid on what Reacher looks like. And it's actually not all that different than Alan, except Alan's better looking. That's the problem with making film and TV, is that actors are all good looking. They're all handsome. That's what they are. And therefore, I think Reacher is not particularly good looking. I think he's a sort of plain looking guy. And not ugly exactly, but kind of ordinary looking. And there are no actors like that. So Alan is a handsome man, but other than that, he is perfect, I think.
Yeah. I wouldn't call much about Reacher ordinary. that's interesting the way he described him. And Nepi Alvitson, he's a big dude. He's a big dude. I've never sort of met him in person, but I imagine he has a certain stature. I mean, the presence that he exudes sort of is immediately apparent, which is perfect for the character. I feel like you have already kind of answered this in a way, but one of the questions that I had written down was, has there been any lesson that you've learned from Reacher that you've sort of taken on and put in your own life? I say that you've maybe kind of already answered this because you said that you put a lot of yourself into the character. So is any reciprocity there, or is it only one way?
That's a great question, because right from the very beginning, I'd been fired from my job, which is why I became a writer. And when I got fired from my job, I was really worried about it because, you know, I had all the normal things like a mortgage and a family and all that kind of thing. And it was mm-hmm. very scary feeling, very insecure. And so I wrote Reacher in the same situation. He had just been essentially fired from his job. Mm-hmm. The Cold War was over. The army was shrinking in size. And certain people were gotten rid of, and Reacher was one of those. So he and I were in the same situation, but he didn't care. He wasn't worried. He was going to take it on the chin. He wasn't going to fret about it in any way at all. He was just going to live his life and have fun. And so I was kind of using him to make myself feel better. And I hope make other people feel better, because I was... lost my job in the 1990s at the same time that lots of other people were. You know, it wasn't just me. It was people in every walk of life was losing their job. And I thought, we need an example. We need somebody who shows that it doesn't matter. They don't worry. They just move forward. So it was a kind of consolation to me. And I hope it was to certain readers who were in the same boat.
I love that. It's a beautiful note to end on. Lee Child, congratulations on season 2 of the show. I hope there's more seasons. I hope I get to chat with you again, because this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
You bet. Real pleasure.
I was given memories of a world I will never see. Loyalty to a king I cannot serve. And love for a child I could not save.
What do you think they want?
Everything.
In the midnight hour, she cried more, more, more. With the rebel moon, she cried more, more, more. Which I think you could also argue is Zack Snyder's directing style. Crying more, more, more. This is
How do you like it? Sorry. Slow motion.
People doing things slow. This is Rebel Moon Rebel Moon - Part 1 : A Child of Fire. That is correct. When a peaceful colony on the edge of a galaxy finds itself threatened by the armies of a tyrannical ruling force, Korra, a mysterious stranger living among the villagers, becomes their best hope for survival. Tasked with finding trained fighters who will unite with her in making an impossible stand against the Motherworld, Korra assembles a small band of warriors, outsiders, insurgents, peasants, and orphans of war from different worlds who share a common need for redemption and revenge.
This is explaining a lot that the movie didn't tell me. As the shadow of an entire... Sorry, spoiler alert for my thoughts. As the shadow of an entire realm bears down on the unlikeliest of moons, a battle over the fate of a galaxy is waged, and in the process, a new army of heroes is formed. Directed by Zack Snyder, with a script by Snyder, Kurt Johnstad, and Shay Hatton, it stars Sophia Boutella, Charlie Hunnam, Mikhail Halsman, Jaimon Honshu, Duna Bay, Ray Fisher, Cleopatra Coleman, Jenna Malone, Ed Skrein, Fra Fee, and Anthony Hopkins as the voice of a robot.
And nice Carrie L. Wells.
Yes, this is like this is as a great cast.
Corey Stoll.
I know. I didn't know he was in that, and I did a full double take because he's got a big Viking beard in it.
So,
I guess. Maybe let's establish, I will be upfront in saying I've tried, you know, in Little Women where Saoirse Ronan's like, I tried and I can't. That's me and Zack Snyder. I have gone into every film understanding that, you know, he has fans and there are people that really love his filmmaking going, I'm going to try to like this one. And I thought with Rebel Moon, maybe because it's an original sci-fi Star Wars-y idea, because he literally pitched this concept to Kathleen Kennedy actually before Disney bought Lucasfilm. It was right in that period when she was co-chair with George Lucas.
Yeah,
because there's a period where Kathleen Kennedy was co-chairing with George Lucas and then Disney came in and bought it. So it was right in that little period. And... you know, she was apparently positive about it. It didn't work out, though. So he's gone off and now made his Star Wars. So, I mean, Hannah, are you more positive on the Snyder? What are your feelings in general?
I there are some things that I liked. I really liked I love Watchmen. I really love that film. I liked Army of the Dead. It's funny. There's certain things with... Snyder movies where I think Watchmen and Army of the Dead are maybe the only two that I've liked as complete films, and like that, whereas there are elements in his other films that I've liked, but there's something that just some fundamental thing that just doesn't work. Like I don't think like Batman v Superman, it's not like it's a bad film, but I guess what I think is it's more that it never quite rises to the challenge or has a misunderstanding of certain things. Like for me, Man of Steel, as much as I really like certain parts of it, you know, I think that, you know, I think Henry Cavill was a good Superman. I think Kevin Costner was a great, like, Superman dad, you know, things like these work, but then it's like Superman doesn't kill. So you've really misunderstood the character. Therefore, it's kind of really hard to, you know, kind of take the whole thing.
Which is interesting here because, you know, this is... it's both Star Wars and it isn't Star Wars. So I don't know if we are allowed to have the conversation of does Zack Snyder understand Star Wars, the material, or not?
Yeah.
I don't know what your...
yeah. I guess what I think the problem is, the interesting thing is that, and I reviewed this for IGN, so thoughts and prayers for me. I think... the fact that it's very clearly an ex-Star Wars script. And I think the problem is Star Wars itself was not an original concept. It was a copy of Frank Herbert's Dune and obviously other little bits and bobs, but primarily it is very much like Dune. So then you're having this kind of, it's a diluted version. So that Star Wars is already a diluted version of Dune. Therefore, this is a diluted version of Star Wars via the dialect version of Doom. So like, I don't mind that he's, I mean, it's really difficult to come up with some original kind of at this point because so much of the canon is so established, like it's hard. So I'm not going to like, I don't have any issues with him if it's like narratively and visually borrows from these things. But he's also very clearly said he's like, he called it Seven Samurais in Space. And it's so funny to me because it's like, why would you, you know, you're talking about a superior film And so the, all the derivative elements, it's like when you see kind of, you know, we were at the premiere and he was talking about all these like influences and stuff. It's like, but each one of these films did it better. And this just never lives up to that, those achievements. So for me, like it's something, it's sad to me because I do think he can be good at adapting properties, except that he's got too many going on here. And so much of it was, there was too much going on in a part one, but also just not enough in the right spaces to really kind of get on board. It was quite hodgepodge, like slapdash, kind of really, yeah, pedestrian, the way these kind of elements all came together. And I don't know you about, like, again, just like the basic story of it. It felt more like, you know, this was originally conceived as a video game. Or like after the pitch for Lucasfilm, there was like, oh, well, maybe we'll try it as a video game. This felt like a video game in the sense of the somewhat, and even the gameplay, that's quite like, meet someone, exposition, meet a new person, exposition, go back to this thing, exposition. And it was just so pedestrian in that way that it was quite boring and tedious.
I actually didn't know about the video game. And that makes a lot of sense because you're so right. It has the plotting of, like, when I play Skyrim and I go up to a guy and he says, travel to this place and talk to that person. And you talk to the person and then you have to go kill a monster and you return to the person and they go, yes, I will join your crew now. Yeah. That's kind of the entire film, right?
Yeah. And also, like, just even, like, the element. Okay, so, I mean, again, the kind of the Star Wars elements of it, like, there's a scene where, you know, you have the kind of, you know, if anything, Sophia Patella's characters are somewhat like Obi-Wan Kenobi as well, as like, you know, but she's actually like Obi-Wan Gamora. That. And then she brings like the nice kid, which is Gunner, who's like the Luke Skywalker in a way, but he's not true. And they go, and then they go to like, we've got to go to this bar. And then there's a bar fight. And then they meet the Han Solo. Oh, no way. It's actually Charlie Hunnam doing a terrible Irish accent playing Kai. And it's these things that, and then, but then even that, I mean, there's even a scene in it where it was exactly like how Harry meets Buckbeak in Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yeah.
And meets, I just don't, it's like, Avatar. Do people watch films? It's so weird. It's like, oh yeah, the Avatar as well. It is an Avatar thing as well. Like the, and again, that's the problem. It could have been, if the dialogue or elements of it were far more exciting or it came at it a different way, it wouldn't feel like you've already seen these things done before. If it was actually told in an engaging kind of, I don't know, there was a bit more to it and the quotes didn't feel like you were reading bumper stickers.
Like, this, yeah, you're so right. And this is the thing for me, is I especially in sci-fi, because sci-fi is totally conceptual and all we have is like other people's ideas of the future and you kind of build on that. So I like don't hold the fact that it feels derivative against the movie at all.
Yeah.
But to me, it's like the thing about Star Wars that is special is that as much as it, yeah, it's a ripoff of Dune, it also came from a place of George Lucas wanting to tell the story of the Viet Cong.
Yeah.
And that's the drive. That's what makes Star Wars special. And
yeah,
this movie, there's no answer to the why. Like, yeah, why are we doing any, I don't know what this movie is fundamentally about, because it's like,
they're, it's a political movie, but they don't, the person who's made it doesn't seem to have a political opinion. Like, doesn't seem to have
We don't know what they're fighting for, because it's established at the beginning that there's been 1,000 years of monarchy, and that was chill.
It was still like, because I think they said something like they were like ruled with an iron fist. Like, it wasn't like they're a happy, peaceful society. It's like everyone, it was like Foundation. That's what like Isaac Asimov's Foundation, where you have, I mean, it's not the same as cloning, but like there was a rule and then it kind of went corrupted by this. And then suddenly the young daughter was supposed to be the new hope of like, I don't know.
Yeah. And then there's a regent that comes in, but the regent's like really even bad. Worse.
Yeah.
And like very like Nazi coded, although apparently it's meant to be the Russians in World War One, and that makes it even more confusing, because if they're the Russians, then who are the good guys. The Germans? I don't know.
Because he was given, Ed Skrein's character was very much like a cross between Darth Vader and like that Ralph Fiennes SS officer in Schindler's List. That's what it means to me.
But supposedly it's not meant to be that. It's meant to be Russia, World War One, which I think that just adds to this idea that in sci-fi, like the visual coding is very important. And like even the costumes I found quite confusing because like the bad guys, yes, like the leaders are in Russian, I guess, Russian military uniforms. But the soldiers are in, it's like half green, of the costume is Desert Storm America. Where I'm like, okay,
But they're medieval knights, right?
But also like Chinese Imperial Army.
Yes. It's like, with the guys who just follow them around. I wish the costumes, I think we talked about this, like it's that racialized civilizations that are far too close to home, therefore, because even like Sophia Boutella, I mean, look, I mean, one thing I quite liked about like the moon of Velt or the Velt that they find them on, I kind of like how sex positive this country, those sort of things, like, it's for the harvest. I was like, okay, cool, love it. But it's also like, that's like you said, Viking, it's a very like Nordic sort of community where they all wearing like it's like peasant farm corps outfits, you know, wearing
it's the very
Henley tops. I don't know,
fantasy Viking.
But it was but it also looked too human. It was too like much like Earth. And then you have Sabiha Boutella coming in, and I mean, of course, she's like, you know, French Algerian. But then the flashback to her country is sandy and stuff, and it's like, so you're and then you have Duna Bay's nemesis, who's on a place, and it's kind of, she's Korean, so, and then even that, so it gets into these, it's quite, it's that thing where there's not enough imagination in presenting these worlds, which, you know, and also so many worlds that you don't really get a sense of them beyond the one location that they're shot in, you know? Because we go to quite a few places, but I have no idea what's going on in these places. I mean, one of them looks like, one of the places at the end, which is so black, it's soundstagey, which is, where it looks like, you know, like, what's that place in Star Wars where, like, the Sith, this Exol, is it, that's what it's called?
Oh, Excogol, where it's like the Death Star crashed.
No, not there. It's the one where, like, it begins with M. I know this is just from playing, like, because I've obviously been playing Lego Star Wars for my entire life.
But it does look
where,
like
the Sith Lords had the Sith, like, home or whatever. But it's like the black monolith sort of blocks things. And you're like, again, there's no sense of, like, I don't understand how these civilizations work. I'm just getting these, like, little minute, and it's so cramped, and I don't really get a sense of, like, these proper worlds at all. So I don't really understand the world building here. It just seems to be,
I was thinking, well, it gets around the problems because obviously sci-fi, you know, I mean, we talk about this, there's so much cultural appropriation going on. And I was like, well, I guess at least like the actor is kind of wearing the clothes of their culture and kind of exists within their culture. So there's no like, it kind of gets around that awkwardness, but you're so right. You end up with a situation where it's like, now we're going to this planet that is just Korea and this planet is like I don't know, the gladiator
ancient
planet.
Italy.
I don't know if that I don't know if that was meant to be like North Africa or something. I don't know, like during the Roman conquest. It's just very, and you don't understand the relationship between the planets, so you don't get a sense of what they're actually fighting for. I don't think anyone says the word democracy at any point during this movie, which I know is not essential, but they talk a lot about like honor and we have to revenge and, you know, we do this because we are warriors. But that's not a rebellion. That's like a different thing. And you called the movie Rebel Moon. And I feel like I want ideals. I want to feel like these rebels are fighting for something. Want something.
And also, exactly. Like, and again, it's just, it's so odd that like in the first bit that this Velt, the villagers are so shocked by the arrival of the Imperium. I mean, that's the name of the army. Because obviously, again, later on we see in flashbacks that like Cora, Sofia Boutella's character, she was one of the main generals, and they go around colonizing and pillaging places. Like, if they're a merchant, if they're giving out grain, they sell grain and stuff, they're self-sustaining sort of farm, whatever. Like, how are they not aware of this stuff going on? It just seems a bit like that makes no sense, that they're so kind of gullible or naive or ignorant, which was, yeah, very, very odd to me. I guess also, you know, we get introduced, I mean, the Seven Samurai, Magnificent Seven, we get introduced to all these characters, and yet they have one scene each, and it really doesn't explain them enough. Like the Tarik, who is, I mean, Conan the Barbarian by Stas Nares, who's got his top off the whole time. Like, so he's a nobleman, and it says like on the Wikipedia, it says he was a blacksmith, and I'm like, there's like one scene
of him doing really blacksmith stuff.
Yeah, but he's like he owes a debt, therefore he's a slave. And then the Duna Bay thing, and again the mixed messaging of like Duna Bay saying, and also I love that none of them help out. They all just stand watching while the other person sorts it out a little bit. It's kind of weird. But then the Duna Bay character is like fighting this like mythical, and it's classic of the we've got to have a mother who's like lost her children face off against a mother who's lost her children, because women can Eve in Zack Snyder films. There's such a very like basic reductive characterization of them where their motivation is either being mothers or I don't know.
Sexual assault.
Yeah.
Which exactly. Also happens in this movie. And it's like the fifth time now. And I feel like one time I'd be like, okay. Two times I'd be like, all right, now. Like, at this point, I don't know if he's aware that he's doing it, but I would love for him to stop.
Yeah.
Because I'm good.
Yeah, it's pretty revolting, isn't it? It's so lazy. And even, you know, some of the positive things I will say about is that, you know, it really proved to me that Sofia Boutella is worthy of a lead role. I do think, like, as much as it is kind of like the strong female character, TM, who's in power, but, you know, she's the leader and stuff. But I like the fact that she's really good at doing the quite vulnerable, like cry, like, you know, tears, but she's also strength. But what was so maddening about the film is that if you've seen her in so many different action films, she's really good at, she's used to be a dancer, she's really good at stunts, she's really good at action fight sequences, and these fight sequences were so lackluster. The way they were shot, they were just quite, you didn't see the full range of movements. Like, it just, even there's a final kind of sort of fight sequence and you're just like, this is boring. This is not really that, I don't know. And I wanted, and that's the thing, I did go into this film, like, I really hope it's great for her. But I don't think it did her justice.
Which I will say this, like, my one big positive that I will always give Zack Snyder is he's great at picking actors. He has a real eye for, like, talent. If you look at, you know, his past cast list, like, and especially this one, it's, yeah, Sofia Boutella, Jaimon Hounsou, who's just always so good in fucking everything, and, you know, always, but he's also a side character here, though. But I think in his head, in Zack Snyder's head, this is more of a character for him, but it just didn't, I don't know, maybe in the 3-hour director's cut he'll release, but
this is,
yeah,
what
Ray Fisher as well,
yeah,
who gets one great speech, but we've just met that guy, so I didn't know what he was talking about.
I guess what I find frustrating about a film like this, where it's like part one and part two, is that I guess, and also the fact that this is a PG-13 version and it's going to be an R-rated version, it's going to be a director's cut, and I just don't understand. It's like, why aren't we being shown the director's cut? Because there was seriously no blood in this, which is kind of like seeing the violence and stuff that he's done. It's like, it's not that I relish violence, it's more that I like to see the consequences of violence, because that actually, especially what's going on now, like, you see all these shots and stuff and it's just kind of a bit, it doesn't hit as hard. So when you see someone get shot, you're not like, oh my God, you're like, oh, okay.
It's more disturbing. It's that, honestly, this has always been my stance. It's more disturbing to me to not have blood because it dehumanizes. I would rather guts and gore and go over the top with it, you know, take away the, because if you go so over the top, which I think Zack Snyder does, it then becomes symbolic, and it's sort of, but doing it like this always makes me feel uncomfortable.
And then, like, you know, it suggests that we're gonna have to find out stuff in the seat in this part two, and I just feel like there's so much you could have done in the part one, and also just not so much, again, the exposition of it. I wish I could see it, not they show it, not say it. Like, even the in the opening bit, like, we, and I feel like my first impression of this dreadnought ship, it was very phallic shaped. Like, it was this very long ship, and I was like, okay. But even the, I mean, I feel like Star Wars' opening scroll is so simple and effective. And so having Anthony Hopkins voiceover as this Jimmy the robot, but then given this lore that didn't really tell us enough, it was quite an info dump. But it was also quite distracting because you're seeing this thing go by, but you don't actually see it. It would have been easier to take in if we could have just seen, like, I mean, again, wouldn't it be amazing if we just saw the murder of the, you know, they said this happened, but we're just following around like this screensaver. I don't know, like on a Windows desktop, and then we go down to the moon. And you know, I will say the CGI for the robot was really good. I thought he looked the Jimmy, the mechanical knights who were, I thought that looked amazing, but cool. He's in it for 2 minutes. Yeah. And then he turns up at the end. Like he's been gone native.
He gets a flower crown.
Yeah, and then like horns.
That's his big character development. He gets a flower crown, and it's like good for him.
I mean, even Lana Del Rey, making a flower. When she's making a flower while she's making a flower crown while he does the exposition. Yeah. It's like, this is so boring.
Yeah, I struggling to listen.
I did quite like Ed's villain. He was kind of like gross and awful, and he had his like gaunt looking. I thought that was he really played up the hammy kind of Brit, that sort of like evil incarnate sort of villain.
Yeah, I didn't. The cantina scene was horrible. I didn't enjoy that at all. No. Because, and this is again the second time he's done this. Is that he does a scene where it's the heroes, or no, the character enters this meant to be like this lair of degeneracy, and is, you know, scans around, and it's just like a bunch of really queer coded people, and I just found it immediately very offensive, because that's that scene in 300 where, what's his face, the guy, the outcast, is like tempted into the Xerxes camp, and it's like a goat playing the guitar and then a load of women making out, and it's like, ooh. And then this one is they go into the canteen of the bar, and there's like the cast of Cabaret there. I don't know how else to describe it. It's just people dressed like they're in the musical Cabaret, and the whole like atmosphere of the scene is meant to be like, oh my god, look at this place. And I'm like, I just find that offensive. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not saying it's intentional or anything, but I would ask to maybe rethink that scene.
I did like the robot, this robot cyborg with the candles for arms. I thought that was quite cool.
He was great, but I was annoyed at the fact I knew the movie didn't want me to laugh.
Yeah.
Right?
And I don't, I guess.
Because he was funny, and I should have gone, ha ha, Candleman. But I knew the movie was like, no, this is very serious.
Yeah. I don't really have much to say about this film.
No.
Oh, we also tried to do the, like, early on, tried to do the Yula Latting, like the human voice at the beginning, and then stopped with that. Which kind of was like, again, trying to be a bit Denis Villeneuve Dooney.
I liked the guys in the background, the badge, they're all dressed like cardinals.
This is what I didn't get. I was like,
what? I don't know what they were doing.
What their purpose was for. Like, no, I couldn't tell what they were doing.
Apparently they're
carrying
like
things around.
A spin-off comic book that's going to explain what
this
they
is
do.
What annoys me. This again is what frustrates me. It's I shouldn't have to do homework to be able to understand the movie in front of me. I shouldn't have to be told, oh no, because I feel like people might come back and say, well, actually, you need to watch this, is this cut, that's cut. It's like, I can only judge the film that's in front of me, and this is the information I've been given. And if you're not giving me enough, then that's on you. I shouldn't have to rewatch a director's cut or listen to a podcast thing, you know, all these things. And even when I was at the premiere, it seemed like a lot of, you know, both Deborah and Zach were trying to make excuses for like, oh yeah, well, you'll find out more about the Motherworld origin on these things. It's like, well, why am I not knowing it now? And I appreciate the difficulty of doing these things, but I guess if it was just the story, that'd be one thing. But I think it was just, everything about it was just like mediocre.
Yeah. And it's meant to be, you know, the supplement, like the podcasts and the comic books and stuff are meant to just deepen your understanding, not provide it. It's the same with video games. They always say, you know, you should be able to play the entire video game without reading a single book or looking at signs. But you look at the signs and you read the books if you want to have a deeper understanding of it. But it's a problem if you actually can't understand it just watching the movie.
I also realized I only like Watchmen and Army of the Dead. I also like Dawn of the Dead, that one. And I suppose my thing about Zack Snyder is that I do think he can be a great director. I guess I wonder if he just needs to get out of his own way a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll ever enjoy his stuff, but I wish him well. this is the kind of thing, like, if I didn't do this job, I would just not interact and I would just let him go do his thing and just go over there and just have fun, have a great time. Mm. But I would like to remove myself from the Snyderverse and just live over in that corner. Right. So let's, there are some very limited cinema screenings of this. So should we do a screen, stream, or skip? Or I guess we do fourth option, wait for the director's cut whenever that's coming. So
I would say skip if you are a Snyder fan. I would say wait for the director's cut, and then that's not even confirmation that's going to be better, but I assume it might be a bit better.
Yeah, I would say skip. Look at a wall. Go look at a wall for 2 hours. Be at peace.
Well,
I'm trying to be the softest, most respectful hater. from someone who I would maybe not call a maestro to the maestro, Leonard Bernstein, this is Maestro.
If summer doesn't sing in you, then nothing sings in you. And if nothing sings in you, then you can't make music. Something she told me.
Hello, I'm Lenny.
Hello, Felicia.
Oh, she's so beautiful. Oh. Tell me about her.
Oh, she's wonderful. She's a lovely girl.
What age are we living in? One can be as free as one likes without guilt or confession. Please, I know exactly who you are.
Leonard, I just met a boy named Leonard, and suddenly that name will never be the same to me. It's too early in the morning to sing that. I have a very rusty voice. But that was meant to be West Side Story. Maria, which Leonard Bernstein, of course, famously wrote. And this is the story. The story of American conductor Leonard Bernstein and his marriage to Costa Rican actress Felicia Montalegre. It's directed by Bradley Cooper, written by Cooper and Josh Singer, and it stars Carey Mulligan, Bradley Cooper, Matt Bomer, Maya Hawke, and Michael Urie. And one other person that I didn't put in this credits because of her outside behavior on social media. But she's in that. Yeah, she's also we're going to not talk about her. So I'm going to be totally honest. I saw this at the London Film Festival, which was now like multiple months ago. And my memory of this film, not great. But I can kind of talk about my, I guess, emotional impressions of it. And I guess the place that I would start with, because I don't think we've talked about this movie yet together.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Bradley Cooper's really talented and I could really see that in this movie. But what I loved A Star Is Born, and I found it so moving because there was a real, like, let me cut my heart out and slam it on the table for you. Like, it was so... it's like so honest and vulnerable and really raw in talking about, you know, pressures of fame, alcoholism, depression, you know, generational trauma, dad stuff. And I feel like this one is a beautiful movie and I can see the emotions there, but it didn't hit for me because I guess I was wanting that same sort of here's everything on a plate for you. Raw quality, and it feels very controlled. Everything's very precise, and everything is, it's kind of to me about the, like, the affectation of emotion. And we can get to the performances, like the performance is very studied, but I think the movie is also very studied. So that's just my initial impression. We could get into it, but I feel like you feel differently about it.
I totally agree that the attention to detail is there, and but I don't see that as I don't think that controls a negative, because I also think that is part of, I guess, what's going on, or my understanding of this kind of relationship, and certainly how we have it told in three specific times, maybe primarily three times in the relationship, or mainly in Leonard Bernstein's life. For me, I really think it captures like the kind of exquisite pain of loving someone who is considered a genius like that. And I think what I really appreciated about this, in the same way that I felt Star Wars War balanced it between the lead, like this is a film which has got very clearly a lead actor and a lead actress. You know, sometimes, like for me, Lily Gladstone is not clearly a lead actor in Killers of the Flower Moon, considering how much screen time she gets, and you know, but like this one's very clear to me that it was both understanding what it means to be Leonard Bernstein and have this kind of this need to be loved by everyone, but also this kind of this ridiculous toxic expectation he puts himself on himself and everyone else to be something, and how that manifests in a very kind of painful way for the people who are trying to love him, especially his wife who's been there. So I think that for me, I felt that, and especially in certain scenes. I mean, there's a scene midway through at Thanksgiving where I just, it felt like very John Cassavetes. Like, I can imagine it's between Jenna Rollins and Peter Falk or something in, like, Women on Air and A Virgin and Ophis Breakdown. Like, that scene for me just said so much about their relationship and kind of like that kind of exposed wound for me. And even some of the things more subtly, like, you know, I'm going to be talking for ages, but I think certain later on, the arrival of a certain character, when it becomes clear that Bernstein's having affairs and how that affects and what it means to kind of the kind of humiliation of that experience by Felicia. So I definitely think it's very controlled and like the exact what you're saying about affectations, but that for me didn't discourage my understanding of like the deep emotional core at play and what it was trying to say and what it was kind of show.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the John Cassavetes, because I think we're going to describe the movie in exactly the same way, but we just had slightly different emotional reactions, because I could see stylistically that he was trying to do that, but I think it's partially to do with the performances, and also like a lot of the camera work. And like, I was the thing that really sticks out, again, this is partially because of my poor memory, but I remember thinking there's this sequence.
Can I just say, it's so funny that I just say that we both saw it. I haven't seen this film again since London Film Festival, but like it's the it kind of speaks to how much we've engaged, how much it sticks in our memory, our enjoyment of
yeah.
it. Because I can remember it so vividly, and you obviously you don't, and I guess it's because you didn't enjoy it as much, so things didn't really stick with you.
Also, I just have a shit memory. But there's the sequence where it's sort of about him composing on the town. And you yes. see, but it's also meant to be this kind of symbolic dance about, you know, his attraction to men.
Yeah.
And, but I remember just looking at the camera work and going, gosh, this is all like just very, it's very concentrated on making sure the audience understands, you know, the symbolic nature of the dance, as opposed to On the Town is such a beautiful, like, this is the thing with Leonard Bernstein's music. There is something so passionate and free about it. And I wanted the camera to match the music in a way, and to just for a moment, like, be lost in the dance. But this is, again, it's really hard to describe, because, like, I'm sure you watched the same scene and probably had the different, but I just remember so distinctly watching that scene going, God, I don't feel connected to the dancing. I don't feel like the camera is loose. And I do think you're right that a part of the, like, directorial choice is to tell this story about, you know, there's a lot about how there's this really clear divide between performer and man, the private and the public person. And there's that scene where he's talking to his daughter, the Maya Hawke character.
Mm.
And they are so, like, don't tell her, do not let her know about his affairs, even though that's such a huge part of his life. And
yeah,
I found that scene really moving, because I think, you know, I think Maya Hawke's great, favorite Nepo baby. Uh-huh. And I think you really feel the psychological effect on her, and how damaging it is to consistently, like, live within a lie. I will say that's a part of the movie that I did like, but I think especially when it's like a guy like Leonard Bernstein, who is such a huge figure, I wanted to see more of the, I guess, the passion of it, and a little bit more of the emotionality there, I guess.
I guess for me, that came through. And also, I really enjoyed the cinematic language of the era in which it was set, used to tell the story. So it's 1943. I love the way it was shot, like a film that was shot in like that time. Obviously, it's black and white. There's romantic. I mean, you know, I love the way that when we first meet Felicia, she gets off a bus and she steps in under a street lamp, and it's like so blocked in such a way that you can imagine it be like, what is it, Elia Kazan, like, you know, a streetcar named Desire. It's like thingy coming off, you know, and things like that, or like the kind of romantic vision of them too. So, but I did, and like the swooping camera shot as he goes from his bedroom to Carnegie Hall.
Oh,
like,
onto the, yeah. That was cool.
So for me, that was really cool. And then when you get to the kind of, you know, 70s, I guess, then it becomes the new Hollywood gritty realism, and it matches the kind of, and I kind of like that fun thing that they were doing. But also, you're talking about like kind of the most impact. I do think it was punctuated by emotional moments, like, God, when Matt Bomer, who is obviously his partner for years before he meets Felicia, and he introduced that moment where the two like, God, people who love this man meet for the first time. They realize that she kind of obviously has some realization who he is, but Matt Bomer kind of realizing, oh my God, he's broken my heart, and what am I supposed to do about it? It's just so painful that, you know, and you know, the Maya Hawke, I definitely felt that as well. But yeah, so it kind of, you know, and even like sometimes it's even just something so silly, like not even silly, but something so small. I think I really appreciate the film is less about, yeah, because I think it's less about how to make a musical. It's not like, or composing. It's not like, you know, Tar, that definitely kind of made you understand what it means to be a composer a bit more, even though it's very much about, you know, about predators and, you know, power. I like the fact that we only have really one scene of Bernstein conducting, and that scene towards the end. And I think it's just amazing the kind of how that, again, I think he's very good at payoffs at the end of a quite big moment. So the Thanksgiving scene, the kind of tension is broken by, I love the fact that suddenly you see a Snoopy balloon go by and the silence. Like, that's amazing. Or like he comes, just does this intense thing. And then suddenly you see that she's been there for him. Like the, she's been there the whole, like watching, and then just kind of goes off this stage and kisses her. And it's like, that's their kind of connection again. And I thought, oh, that's just like, that filled me with so much emotional connection of like, oh, even though they're so, like, he's such an arsehole, he's so frustrating, he does, like, love her. And I really do believe that he loved her so much. Yeah, I just think I kind of really connected. And I just love the fact that we get so much of Carrie in it, her experience without him. It's not just, she's not only in scenes with him. She has scenes on her own, and to kind of understand what she's going through. And, of course, as you know, spoilers, but she gets cancer, and it's kind of then that becomes a thing. And it just worked for me. And also the fact that you've got Bernstein's body of work to be able to use. I love the way they use Jet Song in this film, kind of conflict between, you know, I thought that was really well done. And also just like, I'm just before I pass it back to you, but you know, you're talking about like the certain affectations and like, you know, the clipped accents, all the things that they did, like they really, there's a real study of there. But just as something like the way that they smoke, each individually smoke. I mean, this is how I opened my review for IGN. The fact that he's quite erratic. He's constantly smoking. He's a chain smoker. He's got this anxious energy that he needs to expunge. And smoking is a way to show this kind of constant pressure he's under. Whereas she does it, she's very much more kind of, she takes long drags. She kind of looks out the window. There's this kind of melancholy to it. And those things, again, it's not even, it's non-verbal understanding of who this character is. And I really love that. So that's, I guess for me, I just love all the work that I'm seeing. And I know it might, for some, it's like, you can see the work, but I appreciate the work. And I guess that's what it is, isn't it? It's like what we
right. Because I think that's why I think I, in general, I get a little emotionally disconnected when I can see like the workings on screen. I like mess. I like the messy shit, which is why I put Passages and not Past Lives in my best of the year, even though I thought Past Lives was great. But, you know, I veered more towards the chaos.
Can I ask though, can I just say something though? Because did you watch the Actors on Actors, Bradley Cooper and Emma Stone?
No, I've seen some clips of it, so I might know what you're talking about.
Listening to Emma Stone talk about them, discuss the work that they put in, I do think they are comparative in the sense of I can see the work that Emma's doing, but right. But I appreciate that work, right? So, but I guess
in
you, Poor Things, which will get into later
the
point.
Work.
Yeah, that, I tell.
Yeah. Interesting. I don't see the work in Poor. Obviously, I'm appreciative that she did loads of body work for Bella, but I think I come to this movie with like, I think Bradley Cooper's incredibly talented, like, and I'm really interested to see what he does next. But I think from what I've seen of him talk about the film, he does. Like, he really, like, intellectualizes every single layer of it, which I think shows, like...
He's a true method actor.
Fucking committed to, and I think for me, I benefited more from the way that it came out in A Star Is Born than it did here. And I think his performance, I guess, I think it was the cumulative aspect of, you know, you having the very controlled camera work. The nose, I'll be honest, was a little distracting.
It didn't distract me at all. I thought you looked really hot. I really fancied him. I was like, I fancy you more with this nose.
I think it's because the nose to me is too similar to his real nose that I just kept being like, why didn't he just have his nose?
Yeah.
Like, it's not like he's got like a little tiny
nose
in real life. He's got a great nose.
But I love a big nose. I find big noses attractive.
I mean, they're great. I'm not hating. I love big noses, but I feel like Bradley Cooper already has kind of the nose needed.
Mm.
And do you get what I mean? It was like too close to reality that I had a bit of like an uncanny valley moment with the nose. Which is different from like Nicole Kidman in The Hours, where she has a tiny nose in real life. So it was that. And then I remember noticing like he clearly must have studied hours and hours and hours of footage of Bernstein, because I can notice the laugh, like the laugh was really perfectly done. As you said, the way he holds the cigarette is like perfect. And I think maybe it was just all of those elements together. That's when it became a little too much. That's when I could see the working a little too much. Mm. As opposed to if maybe I was given two or one of those elements on their own, I would have become total. Because I think it's the difference between total immersion and I am aware of that I am being presented a piece of craft, if that makes sense. But what did you, I will say, just the performances, Matt, you mentioned Matt Bomer. He was the standout for me. Because, you know, I've seen American Horror Story, so I've been, you know, tooting the Matt Bomer horn for a while because he's great on that show. But he does Broken Heart so well.
Because he's got such big eyes, puppy dog eyes.
Yeah.
He's so good at it.
Because, God, there's a storyline in American Horror Story where he gets his heart broken and it gets me every single fucking time.
Yeah.
And doing it here again, like... he's great. But what were your thoughts, performances?
Yeah, no, honestly, Matt stood out. I guess it's interesting because I feel, Maya, I thought was great. But I really loved everything that Carrie and Bradley did. I was thinking about a scene later on where, like, Carrie's regaling a story. I think in Maya's there as well, like, as the daughter, their daughter. Carrie's regaling a story about the guy, her co-star or something. They go on a date and then I don't want to give too much of it away, but it was just one of those moments where it was just so, again, this kind of, not cringe, but just the pain of knowing that some sort of the rejection, I guess. And I think Carrie, I just really felt that sense, keen sense of rejection and frustration. And even though... she's obviously kind of a super privileged woman, you know, she's got everything going to her. There is something quite, mournful and melancholy about her situation where, you know, you're kind of in the shadow of such a big personality and it's just wanting to be seen and you're kind of withering because you don't get much of the sun. Mm. And I thought that was quite beautiful. Also, I just thought it was quite funny in places. I quite like how campy Brett Cooper did it. There's a really funny scene where, like, he's at a party doing coke. I just thought it was just so funny to me. Just kind of the ridiculousness.
It was really funny.
Yeah. And I think what I like about it, it's not, I guess I like the work, but I also like that he's completely unselfconscious in this. Like, he's just fully committed to this. And, at first, I guess it's sometimes interesting when you have certain accents that you don't really hear anymore, you know, certain things. But for me, it made me feel like these are real people, like rather than someone just doing the typical kind of, oh, I'll just do a certain voice and then suddenly that's it. It's like I felt like the personalities came through for me as well. It wasn't just imitation, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. It's interesting.
But also, I haven't watched a lot of Bernstein. I don't know who these people are, so I couldn't tell you if it's imitation or not. I just saw them as real people, not caricatures of a certain time.
Yeah, to be fair, I've not watched that. I've not watched, like, tons of footage of him. But I sort of assumed that he did a very pitch-perfect impersonation. From the little that I've seen, and also, he was clearly putting the work in, so I think I just trust him. To be like, I think Bradley Cooper's probably got it. So should we do our... I think it might still be in a couple of cinemas, but it's coming to Netflix very soon.
22nd. So should we just say... Next
20 seconds. So maybe let's do stream or skip, because you might have missed your opportunity to screen it.
I'm going to say... screen if you can. Definitely stream.
Yeah, I would say definitely stream, but just a bit less. Boo on me. I'm the hater this week.
You truly are. You're hating Netflix this week.
I'm sorry, Netflix, don't cancel my account. from The Boy and the Her, his wife to the boy and the her on the boy and the heron.
Mahito.
So, you made it.
Mother!
Have a seat.
It's this way, Mahito.
A lot of strange things happen in this place.
Please join us. I just hope he stays safe.
Save me.
Save me, Mahito!
What exactly are you?
Dear mother. She's awaiting your rescue.
Right, birds can fly so high and they can shit on your head. Yeah, they can almost fly into your eye and make you feel so scared. But when you look at them and you see that they're beautiful, that's how I feel about you. And what's funny is there's a lot of shit in this movie.
Yeah.
That was Kate Nash, Birds. Do you remember? Do you know Kate Nash?
She always ran at the station.
He was getting off the train.
Foundation song, but I don't remember her doing other songs.
She had a whole album, Clarice. You had to be there.
Sorry, Kate Nash. I was there, but I wasn't fully there, I guess.
Mahito, a young 12-year-old boy, struggles to settle in a new town after his mother's death. However, when a talking heron informs Mahito that his mother is still alive, he enters an abandoned tower in search of her, which takes him to another magical world. Written and directed by Hayao Miyazaki, it stars Soma Santoki, Masaki Suda, Aimeon, and Yoshino Kimura, with an English dub featuring the voices of Luca Padovan, Robert Pattinson, Karen Fukuhara, Gemma Chan, and Christian Bale. So this is obviously a Studio Ghibli joint, and yes, I now officially know how to say Studio Ghibli, so I will say Studio Ghibli as much as I can.
Isn't there a lot, there's like a lot of debate about how to pronounce it.
Do you know how I know how to pronounce it? Because a Japanese person, TikTok, was like, it's really weird, he said something like, it's really weird when I see people debate whether it's Studio Ghibli or Studio
Ghibli
or Ghibli. And he was like, and it's weird because as a Japanese, I've only ever heard it pronounced Studio Ghibli.
Ghibli. But is it not, it's not a Japanese word though, right? It's not like an anglicized, I think that's where the confusion comes from.
To Godzilla one movie, but I do feel like, I feel like it's the same way that you say you don't pronounce the, when you see a W in like Polish or Russian, you pronounce it as a V rather than a W. So in when Japanese, you pronounce it an L as an R, which we found in Godzilla Minus One. But I feel like...
Yeah, but I think the actual word, I think that's where the confusion stems from, because I think the actual word is not Japanese. If I remember reading about it.
Maybe. But I guess I just want to pronounce it the way Japanese pronounce it. And if the Japanese pronounce it,
Studio
Ghibli.
Ghibli.
I want to double. I feel like that's how you, that sounds.
I think you might be right.
It sounds better also. Doesn't it sound better? Ghibli.
Because Ghibli always makes me think of giblets.
Yeah. But I guess what do they say? Ghibli Attack? What do they call it? In the podcast, they say,
oh, yeah.
Ghibli Attack or Ghibli Attack?
That's not their problem.
Look, that's not the Japanese person.
That's their burden to figure out how to pronounce that.
Cross the bear. Okay. That was a long thing about the words. I'm sure someone's going to tweet me saying you're totally incorrect, but I don't care. So I guess, are you a big fan of their films? I have to say, I'm sometimes hit and miss with them. I really like Howl's Moving Castle. I really like Spirited Away. What was the recent one that they did? I didn't get on with My Neighbor Totoro. I found that a bit.
I love My Neighbor Totoro.
Yeah, it's weird. But this one I really enjoyed. I found it to be like really moving, gorgeous, and obviously completely kooky. And I kind of like that, how weird these animations are. And even in 2D, it just shows the beauty of it. What's your kind of relationship with the studio?
I love these movies. I feel like I'm not, because there's people who are like passionate about Studio Ghibli, and I don't think I'm,
yes,
I'm
converted. That. She's converted.
Yeah, I mean, if that's how I meant to say it, I'm gonna say it like that. But yeah, I really love. I think I really love the ones that are more grounded in, like, the mythical stuff. I love Spirited Away. I love My Neighbor Totoro, especially after I read that he's actually like a spirit of death and the kids are dead, which is really dark. But I feel like it adds to the movie. Yeah, and I like all the movies where it kind of interacts with the Shinto religion, and you have all these, is it the kami, the spirits? And I feel like this one's very like that, so I enjoyed it a lot. I love seeing... although I feel like the magical world in this also felt quite... it felt like it had a lot of Western influences as well. It felt quite like Alice in Wonderland at one point. And you see there's like a bit where there's an ocean of like English looking ships with big sails and things. So I just loved the imagination, the big parakeets.
Fascist parakeets.
The fascist parakeets. I think like what this movie does that is maybe my favorite thing about the studio is like having this whimsy and all this imagination and this humor and this adventure. But then when you kind of like the movie ends and you go to sit down and you think about it, then all the metaphors start rising to the surface. Yeah. And you go, oh my God, this is actually about Japanese history. Oh my God. Here we go.
100%. Yeah, I really appreciate that. They really respect the intelligence of their audience, no matter the age. I think, you know, we are getting to a time where, and actually it's a really good, I suppose it's quite good to kind of pair it with Godzilla, because similar time zones and kind of grappling with like the kind of, I think a lot of Japanese cinema does grapple a lot with the end of like Imperial Japan, and kind of how, and you know, it's interesting because you said the Western influences, but that's also part of like the history of, from when the empire kind of started during like the, is it Meiji Restoration? And then towards the end, and that was Western influences and the corruption of that and this kind of structures. And so when you see the kind of Western images within this kind of magical world, and even just the kind of idea of this person who's keeping this tower, and it's like, you've got to keep the piece together, but it's like, no, it needs to fall, it needs a new hands. And it's like, it's so, when you're watching it, you're kind of like sucked in, and after it's like, oh, that's it's this crumbling tower and the world needs to collapse to something new. I think that's just so intensely just like smart and intriguing and just well telling stories where it doesn't feel overtly political, but it's very, like these are all political films. I think it gets to that point where like some films nowadays, you know, I actually was on Front Row this week and we're talking about Chicken, and I was asked to talk about Boy and the Heron, and then you have Chicken Run, and you know, Chicken Run, of course, is serviceable and it's fun and entertaining, but it's not challenging. It's not even challenging your kind of sense of humor as much, even though it's funny, but it's not as funny. And I feel like Studio Ghibli are not just, when Miyazaki is not just making films for the sake of making films. He has something to say and wants to say it, and it's with deep respect for the audience's intelligence. That they're going to offer them something that is nutritious rather than just delivering something because, you know, fast food. And I think that's where we've got into nowadays. There's so much fast food out there that has empty calories that people will just take because audiences are desperate for something new. And actually people will just watch things. And the problem with streaming services is that I guess there's a sense of both doing great work for diversity, but also not doing enough work to ensure what the quality's there. So it's very much quantity over quality. And I when I watch The Boy and the Heron, I'm just reminded of what can be achieved if, you know, we, you know, actually take their audiences seriously.
Yeah, and I think there's this idea that, yeah, I think that, you know, I don't know if the internet's probably not helped with this at all, this idea that people get, like, angry if they don't understand something, right? The movie's too complicated, or there's some message that they haven't quite grasped. The reaction is like anger towards the film and fuck that movie. Ugh, it's pretentious. And I feel like The Boy and the Heron is a nice example of, as you said, putting trust in the audience and understanding that, you know, kids are obviously not going to go, oh, this is about, you know, when they talk about, I think there's a line about building a new world without malice. Is that I remember that line. The kids are obviously not going to understand that, oh, this is about, like, yeah, how do you kind of reconstruct a new Japan post-imperialism? But, you know, generational trauma, and there are generational inherited feelings inside of kids that there are things around them that they may see and not be able to process. And the kids can still... This is the thing, you cannot really understand what a movie's about and still process the emotions and still be affected by it. And there's something happening in the subconscious where maybe your subconscious feelings about Imperial Japan are also interacting with the subconscious emotions that the movie are giving you. And I think that's what Studio Ghibli have always been really good at. You know, for example, with My Neighbor Totoro, you could choose to decide that he is a spirit of the dead or not. But maybe subconsciously, even if you don't decide that he's a spirit of the dead, maybe that's still going on in your brain. I don't know if I know enough about Japanese history to understand every single, like, thing that was... I probably have to go sit and research it a bit more. There's things I think I missed. Maybe the parakeets are significant. But I don't guess think that...
Because it's got a king and it's the feudal Japan. That sort of kind of...
Yeah. But, like, the choice of parakeets. The fact that they're parakeets important.
Actually, I hadn't even thought about that. Maybe there is something about the parakeets that's specific. But I think it's just like, again, they're the fascists trying to maintain a certain thing. And it's actually, we need to move on. And I like the idea of, like, the grandfather, and then it's a younger child, the next generation coming through. But also, I would say as well, you know, it has a lot in common with traditional fairy tales about teaching kids about, and again, I'm sorry, we're bringing it a lot about kids, but also because actually these films are for adults as well, of course they are. Fairy tales is how kids learn about death and stuff. And in this one, you have someone who's, you know, I love how broken so many of these homes are, like a mother's dealing with the grief of that. And I suppose, again, in a way, there's something about, like, all of us as strangers as well about this, in the sense of, what would you do if you can meet your mother? Like, you know, talk to them. I guess it's that sort of ends, that kind of closure you get in it in such a beautiful and magical way, and also just, like, so weird. It doesn't shy away from death, and I think it's that's the power. And I think it doesn't, you know, I think we do end up being in a we can get into a culture as well of trying to sanitize those elements, I guess, more explicit elements of it. I don't know. I found it quite, very, very moving.
Do we just want to say, I have only seen the Japanese. Did you see Japanese or English?
Okay, let's go there.
I haven't heard the English dub, so can't
I haven't, but Robert I did hear Pattinson. A little of Robert Pattinson's clip on it. Everyone's raving about it.
But I think is it Masaki Suda, the Japanese actor who plays? So Robert Pattinson is the Heron, and Masaki Suda is also the Heron, I believe.
Yeah.
Both, I heard a little bit of Robert Pattinson's, but he seems to be doing an impression of the original actor, which is a great vocal performance.
But also, maybe it's not that he's just doing it. Maybe it's not that he's doing an impression. Maybe it's more like I think sometimes when you have English dubs, they downplay the voiceover, because I think what's what I quite like about, like, anime and kind of Japanese animation is there's such an, like, over the topness to it, like, everything's quite emotional, evocative,
really passionate, like, expressive, and really, like, a variety of voices as well. English dubs are, everyone's like, hi, I'm the character, I'm also the character.
It's more kind of grounded, and I like the fact that Japanese anime doesn't, because it's like, or like, I mean, I suppose in this case, I like the fact that it kind of has a bit more as you said, expressiveness. So maybe he's trying to do that, but Yeah, give it Robert Pattinson. Stay weird, Rob. What are you saying, Clarice?
Screen. And yeah, I guess I haven't seen the English dub, but I think I'm a big subtitles girl, so.
Yes, I prefer subtitles at cinemas, though, because sometimes when I watch subtitles at home, my eyes get tired, but maybe it's just because I just don't sleep very well. But it's definitely a screen from me, too. Well, we're going from one Japanese tale to another. Here is Godzilla Minus One. It's cuffing season and all the girls are leaving to get a big boy. I need a big boy. Give me a big boy. I don't think that's correct.
It was very close.
Close? Okay.
But the point is, Godzilla is a big boy.
Is he a big boy?
Because he's a big boy.
What I mean is, he had some big titties.
Yeah, we had like big, he was curvaceous.
He was thick. Thighs. I can't tell. You know what he reminded me of? He reminded me of Meatloaf in Fight Club.
My mind did not go there, but okay.
So now you're saying he's a boy. I thought it was a lady. It's a lady Godzilla. Actually, Dr. Godzilla to you.
I think okay. Godzilla is only a girl Godzilla in the
West.
1999. Because in the Gareth Edwards, it's a boy Godzilla.
But maybe is it 98,
yeah. Because then there's the little babies. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't be applying gender concepts to Godzilla.
Yeah, maybe it's both. Maybe it's non-binary.
Yeah.
Feeling as if he unfairly cheated death too many times, Shikishima, a surviving kamikaze pilot, is attacked on Odo Island, along with many warplane engineers, by a gargantuan monster. After the engineers die due to Shikishima failing to distract the monster, an overwhelming amount of guilt weighs on him, especially after a homeless woman and a baby move into his home when he returns. Shikishima, now on a personal mission, teams up with a large group of veterans to finally take down the monster known as Godzilla. Written and directed by Takashi Yamasaki, it stars Ryunosuke Kamiki, Minami Hamabi, Yuki Yamada, Munetaka Aoki, and Hidetaka Yoshioka. So, Godzilla Minus One, the title. Can you explain that to me?
I am not actually sure, but, well, because it's sort of, if we were Hollywood executives, I feel like we would call this a reboot.
Right.
But Japan's a bit too cool to be using that kind of stupid language. So they're just like, here's another Godzilla movie.
Well, someone suggested to me that it was because after the war, Japan, after Hiroshima, Japan was at zero. And then now with Godzilla, it was minus.
Okay, maybe.
Minus one.
Oh, okay, that might explain. I don't actually know. I kind of assumed it had to do with the fact that, for the most part, I mean, we had, obviously, the original Godzilla took place kind of post-war. But since then, the Godzilla movies either kind of take place in present day or sometimes they go into the future.
Yeah.
And there's like time travel shit. But this is like a period film.
Yeah.
Which is quite different. Like Shin Godzilla was modern day because that was like a response to the Fukushima disaster.
Yeah. And that's what's the interesting thing, isn't it, about Godzilla historically, right? Because Godzilla has been representative of that sort of the devastation of Hiroshima, right? And the bombing of that, the fact that it just comes and, you know, the radiation after effects. So it's so interesting that this is now set specifically, rather than it's not just a metaphor for that, but it takes place after that. So it's kind of really interesting seeing, I suppose, just this representation of it where it's kind of literal, the literal effects, the literal and the metaphor, and Japan just basically like, fuck, how do we recover?
Yeah, and it's what I find, I really loved this, and I really love Godzilla. And I think he's a powerful icon, but also quite flexible because he is a creature of atomic disaster. That's quite literally in his backstory. But also, you know, Shin Godzilla, which is fantastic if people haven't seen it, is 2016. Yeah, that in that one, it is more about the like bureaucratic response to Fukushima. So it's sort of it isn't about the atomic bomb. And then this one, again, like it is about the atomic bomb because there are all these visual, like I found quite terrifying, really effectively done kind of visual representations of Godzilla's devastation being like the atomic blast.
Mushroom I mean, cloud, that's yeah.
a fucking atomic blast. Like that yeah. is terrifying, that scene. And then you kind of see the crumbling cities and you see them building houses on top of crumbled foundations. Like it's all very powerful imagery. But also the Godzilla, that synopsis you gave kind of sets it up. Godzilla becomes this symbol of survivor's guilt as well, because you have this main character, Shikishima, who's a kamikaze pilot who grounds his plane. And then he has this just terrible guilt, like he feels like he hasn't done his duty. And you know, I would be upfront, the film is critical of that. It's not a pro kamikaze movie, because the film is also trying to talk about the lingering trauma, not just of the atomic bomb, but also this post-war feeling of like the carelessness of human life. And it's critical of how Japan just like did not just used its people as like weapon, yeah. you know, didn't care for the human life that they were putting into these wars. For example, with the kamikaze pilots, or like not providing tanks that just aren't fit for purpose. And so you have this idea that like the Godzilla's kind of like the specter that's haunting him throughout the entire movie, because every time he sees Godzilla, he's like reminded this idea that he lived and other people didn't.
Yeah.
So it's like really, like it's, I would say it's quite a fun movie because they also defeat Godzilla. Spoiler alert. But they fight Godzilla in it, and that's always fun. But there's a lot to it that's like really quite emotional and quite like, God, okay, this is getting into really like hard shit about, you know, Japanese cultural trauma.
I guess my thing about it is that I think it's definitely like B-movie vibes. And certainly in the sense of, I think somewhat the caliber of the acting, I did feel like it a little bit kind of hammy. Some of the dialogue was a bit cheesy, yeah. You know, and it's also the kind of sort of honor is such a big part of culture, and certainly East Asia as well. Like in a way that, you know, what the West isn't as much, like, you know, there's actually a really powerful scene, like why he comes back to his like house and it's like, why are you even here? You should have died. Like, you know, that is like brutal. Like you didn't, you're a coward, and all these things, a sense of honor, and trying to reclaim that honor as well. So I think there's those, it kind of, there is that definitely like some potent kind of powerful elements of storytelling, but sometimes it does veer into quite, I don't know, I guess this is kind of like a Train to Busan. You know what I mean? In the sense of, it's kind of genre film. There are quite beautiful elements, but sometimes it does play into the more kind of cheesy bits of it and cheesy beats that kind of made me a bit like eye-rolly that I can somewhat connect to. But, you know, I also, there's certain things that I kind of had an affection for this film. You know, even like the kind of the doc who has clearly dyed his hair gray and got this like quite anime sort of like manga haircut, who's like the scientist who's telling them how to do stuff. I thought that kind of ragtag. I mean, the fact that it was like a Jaws element to it as well, when they're in the kind of the ocean, it's quite funny. It's kind of silly in that way. I didn't love it. I liked it. I think, yeah. And I guess what I also liked about it compared to a lot of, you know, Western version of it is that, I guess he's the baddie. They don't try to pretend that he's like the goodie. And I guess we're in this point, like, point in time where there's so much, like, Western guilt about everything. It's like, I guess because you're making about climate change and stuff like that, but so many times we have, like, the Godzilla films, it's like humans are the bad guys, I guess, which I don't really mind, but I quite like the kind of something going back to, no, this is a monster and it's survival of the fittest and you're going to die if you don't kill it. And yeah, fair enough, he might be stronger, but, like, this is dog eat dog. It's Godzilla eat Godzilla, man, or Godzilla eat humans. So you got to fight back.
Which this is one I'm interested in knowing what conversations are being had in Japan about that, because he's quite, like, Godzilla's quite loved. You know, you go to Tokyo and there's, like, statues of him sticking out of buildings, and there's a slide. You can go on the Godzilla slide. This is the thing I feel like I can't say from a Western perspective, is if Godzilla Minus One in Japan, it feels like it's, like, resetting the Godzilla, like, what Godzilla means, that Godzilla is scary again, or, because I guess, like, yeah, again, Shin Godzilla, he's quite scary, but he's quite weird in that, so he's a bit less intensely scary.
I think there's funny moments in,
yeah.
I think there's funny moments about, like, where there's bits where he's, like, in the water, and he's kind of standing up, it's like, so is he just treading water?
I know, like, I was imagining his little feet.
Little feet, like a little duck treading water. Also, doggy, like, paddling. Again, he, like, the way he shot, his head is so small compared to his body. It was, like, and then he's, like, has these, like, tits, and they're so titty. And then, mm-hmm. like, his thighs, thick thighs. I mean,
yeah, his body goals.
It's just, it's so silly. I quite like the way that the atomic thing came out. I love the shift in the spikes on the back. I thought that was quite fun.
Yeah, and it's so well shot because it goes so slowly and you're like, fuck here. I love in action movies, in disaster movies, that slow, like, you know it's fucking coming and you're just waiting for it.
Yeah.
And I feel like this does it very well.
And also I like that it tried to be like, we're going to beat this thing with science, not brute force. Like, we have to beat it. He's not going to beat it. We have to use brains. Yeah. It's so dumb, but also...
But respect.
It's kind of the same way, like, you know, the Meg 2. Like, the science, jury's out on science in this film. But I kind of like when it tried to do something a bit, you know, whatever. I'll allow it because it's you know, it's like, that's the concept of this. It's trying to be a bit silly. And I guess this is trying to be a bit silly, even though it's quite, it's got like an emotional core to it. Okay, well, this is anything else you wanted to... I thought the production design on this, I will say, was actually quite amazing. I thought the way that these, like, the kind of houses, even though it's quite self-contained, I thought they did a really good job on that, actually, where it felt, it didn't look like a, you know, soundstage and stuff. It didn't look cheap. I thought it looked quite well done. And I imagine it's not got a massive production budget.
I think it's got I don't know, it's comparative. I think it's got a big production budget for Japan, but, like, if you would say it in Hollywood terms, but then you have to remember that Hollywood, like, it's a lot of red tape.
It pisses a lot of money away as well.
And money going in places going, oh, where did that money go? Oh, bye.
Yeah. Okay, so let's do a screen, stream, or skip verdict on Godzilla Minus One.
I would screen, but I am a Godzilla fan, so maybe, but I really enjoyed it.
I wonder if, I do think that this is a type of film that I think your enjoyment would benefit to see it on the big screen, because on a bigger screen.
Yeah.
I did feel like maybe part of my, I think there's something about the elements of it that maybe I was watching at home and I was watching with someone and we kind of got chatting a bit too much about it. So it's kind of like, watch it on the, if you're going to see it, I would recommend go seeing it at a cinema.
Oh my God, I didn't say the best part. It's when the fucking theme kicks in.
Oh my God, yes. It
and it's like, bah, bah. Oh.
Oh my God.
See it but at every the cinema time just for that. Just when the theme, you know, the Godzilla theme kicks in.
But then every time it did that, I just kept it going, da 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 da, get the fuck out. Simon Says, get the fuck out.
Me too. And I'm kind of mad at that song for ruining the Godzilla theme, but it's a great song though.
Okay, well, it's now time for our final interview with Amon. This is Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget.
Cock-a-doodle-doo!
Life doesn't get better than this. We've put the past behind us. We have Molly to think about now.
What a bonnie wee hen!
I made her a bicycle!
Okay, Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget. Having escaped from the farm, Ginger and Rocky welcome a new little adventurer into their lives. Back on the mainland, the whole of chicken kind faces a terrible new threat. This is directed by Sam Fell, and it stars Tandiway Newton, Zachary Levi, Romesh Ranganathan, and Bella Ramsey. Last week, we reviewed Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget. Both myself and Clarice were pretty big fans of this one. And I actually spoke to Sam Fell a couple months ago when he was here for the London Film Festival where Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget was playing. It was a really fun chat, including us going through some of the potential alternative titles this film could have had. That spawns a particularly fun answer, that question. And there's a couple of other fun answers as well. Here's that chat, me, Sam Fell, and Chicken Run, colon, Dawn of the Nugget.
Welcome to the Bed Bang Podcast, Sam Fell. Oh, cool.
Hi, I'm good, thank you. Yeah, very excited.
Congratulations on the film. I had a good time with it.
Excellent.
I was reading up on some of the interviews that you've done for this, and I know that you said when you were first coming on board of this, you said you had a mixture of fear and desire.
Yeah.
Was there any day when you were working on this when the fear was gone and you were just confident you were making a release of the fun film?
Yeah, it took probably a few years, really, to be honest. I mean, I was always excited, and it's always great. It's delightful thing to do, you know, make these films in this way, you know, because I don't know if you've ever been to a studio that makes these things,
you
but
guys invite me down for some reason.
I think I should put you on the list. Yeah. It's like being in a big toy shop, you know, because you kind of look around and all the puppets are over there and the sets, and you're literally surrounded by your film and you can see it and touch it. So on one level, it's always a good day to be doing this, but yeah, Chicken Run in particular is pretty daunting because everyone loves it so much. And people feel like they've got a kind of ownership of it, actually, like a lot of people. And Pete and Nick, I've known them for a long, long time, and you know, they let me play with their chickens, and you know, like, I don't want to kind of mess it up. So, but yes, it did take a while, but you know, in the end, I found my way in, and it's really because it's such a long time since the first movie that I've found a way. I kind of started thinking that it's more like a reboot, in fact, than a sequel. And it's a new chapter. And as much as I love the first movie and I adore it and respect it, it's fantastic. I didn't just want to make a homage, you know, and be too precious. I wanted it to evolve and make a story and a new film for now, for these times, and a new chapter. So yeah, I found my feet, and I think, you know, like, finding the heart of the story was key. Molly was the main thing in the end, was to think about Ginger initially, fabulous sort of iconic hero, female hero of the first movie. She finds her happy ending. She's got everything she wanted. Is she gonna live happily ever after? You know, like, what's the next challenge? Motherhood, you know, like, give her a daughter and make that daughter like a chick off the old block, you know, like, she's just like her mom. She's a freedom seeker. She's adventurous, you know, she wants to. And so that really sparked it for me, you know, like, that really gave me the story. And Molly in particular was my way in. She's new, hatching a new character, literally. And I've been a parent all this time. And in fact, my son was a child when I started this, and now he's grown up and left home and lives in Amsterdam, you know. So that whole journey, you know, I'm very familiar with, you know, like, and just how quickly that happens.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
You mentioned wanting to make this film for the now.
Yeah.
And this was a 6-year-long process.
Yes.
Were there any real world events, because the world has changed a lot.
Oh, my word, yeah.
That manifested itself on the screen, on this film.
Yeah, it's funny, actually, because there's a certain sort of timeless quality to it that I, you know, want, of course. You know, like we take so long to make the film and we want it to live forever. You know, we want people to be watching it over decades. Mm-hmm. So that, well, there's that big timeless thing. But actually, if you look at the first movie, a lot of the seeds were already planted, you know, like strong female character, strong female cast, you know, in some ways a feminist movie about our relationship between humans and animals and, you know, food. And, you know, the stakes are very high, you know, like the level of danger that they're facing. So all of that stuff was already there in a way, you know. So you start making this movie. You know, we started, we weren't sure whether it should be Ginger's story. We played with Rocky's story for a while. It became clear, you know, in the world as it is now that, you know, strong female characters, is you know, maybe the 21st century is the female century, you know. But that was already there from the first film. So we were naturally in a good place, I think, you know. You know, food and animals, you know, I mean, really we picked The Dawn of the Nugget more as a kind of a funny, dramatic idea, you know, like we wanted the challenge to be bigger and badder than last time. So Tweedy's farm was bad, what could be worse? You know, industrial scale farming, you know, and industrial scale food production, you know, like the, how awful would The Dawn of the Nugget be if you were a chicken, you know, and that idea of it being a Bond villain's revenge on the whole of chicken kind. So they're also like quite organic, you know. We never really sat down and thought, right, what are the issues we want to talk about? And so it's happened quite naturally, which is a good thing, I think, you know, that it's just intrinsic to the storytelling.
You bring up Mrs. Tweedy there, so yeah. I gotta talk about Mrs. Tweedy.
Yeah.
I read that when you came on board, there was a different villain.
Yeah. So different villain.
Can you talk to me about the motivation behind bringing back Mrs.
Tweedy? Yeah.
Answer, let me just say thank you because.
Oh yeah. Well, Mrs. Tweedy, I think, is like one of the great animated villains of all time. Actually, yeah. You know, like I think she's up there with Cruella De Vil. You know, I think she's fantastic, and I always had a feeling about her. And Nick kept saying, what about Mrs. Tweedy? But we had a male villain. It was a more, you know, for some reason we went that way. We just thought it'd be interesting to kind of bring a new villain, new film, new villain, you know. And you know, Bond does that, you know. The key was Ginger again, you know. Like, so when we kind of went, all right, this is Ginger's story. You know, she's a mother, she's got this kid. We started really thinking about Ginger as a dramatic character and, like, getting inside her head and what would she think and feel. And, you know, like, what if she were, like, she'd be, like, really haunted by Mrs. Tweedy, you know? Like, we looked at Aliens, and, you know, in that movie, like, Ripley doesn't want to go back down. At the beginning, she's like, I don't want any part of this, because she's just it makes her shudder to think of what happened. So she's sort of haunted in her subconscious by the shadow, and that she's going to have to face that. You know, like a hero has to face their deepest fears. And it felt like Mrs. Tweedy would be that, the deepest fear. And the delicious idea of a rematch, you know, the nemesis. And just great fun to think of her as a supervillain now, you know, and give her the makeover. And, you know, like, because the movie shifts into the 60s now with the, you know, the fast food or the colourful world of nuggets. And she just was the perfect Bond villain, actually, once we got into that.
Yeah. I love that. You got Melinda Richardson for that role. So first part of this question is, what was it like her back in the booth day one doing that voice? The second part of the question is, you're recasting a bunch of roles. You got Tatooine, Newt, you got Zachary Levi. How are you directing them? Because I'm guessing a part of it is, yes, you want that synergy between this film and the old film, but you also want them to make the character their own.
They've got
to
be their own,
What are you saying to them before takes in order to help them do that with their performance?
Right, yeah, interesting, yeah. Like, well, to bring Miranda back and to be there on day one, take one, first line, and as soon as she opens her mouth and speaks, it's like, the hairs stand up on the back of your neck, you know, it just absolutely makes you shudder. And she's brilliant. I'm so in awe of her, you know, and I've grown up with her, you know, and she's she's so kind of daunting, you know. It was kind of daunting, to be honest, you know. But we looked at different casting, you know, like long story, it's maybe a bit of a long way around, but we started by casting Molly, of course, and bringing the new characters in, which gave us so we had a casting director, and they tried out lots of different, you know. I said, well, what would you do with the cast now, you know, just out of interest, you know, and so they made suggestions, but none of the suggestions could match Miranda, you know. Like, Miranda, she can do comedy and drama in the same moment. Like, she can scare the pants off you and make you laugh in the same moment. And that's how I was. I was, like, laughing, but, like, kind of nervous. So that was great. But it's definitely been a thing for me to figure out how to make this next chapter of Chicken Run. It's so beloved, and it's such a masterpiece, you know. And the casting of the first movie was perfect. It was brilliant. But it's a long time since then. And so I just got interested in, like, what would happen if we tried different voices, you know, like who could be new. So I think it just, as I say, the casting director made some lists for me, and I started to look, and some people started to pop out. And Tandy Wayne Newton was one of them. You know, I sort of really loved what she did in Westworld. And there's a kind of, she's very strong, but she's very vulnerable in Westworld. And I think that's Ginger in this story, you know, like she's the strong hero she was in the first film, but having a daughter makes her vulnerable, and the fear of Tweedy. So there's a slightly more complex role, you know. And so yeah, I just said that to Tandy Way, you know, like, you know, we talked through the character. She's like super smart. She's got a fantastic voice. So it's just in that the casting choice, she was already right, you know. So it was like, you know, she's brilliant. She's like one of the greats, you know. She's so seasoned. So I just said to her, do your thing, you know, like, just get into this role, get inside her. And so there was never that question. Zachary actually on the first day said, you want me to do Mel? Because he's so helpful, you know, like, he's such a nice guy, you know. And he was like, and I was like, you know what? And I think he tried it for like 5 minutes or even a couple of minutes. And I was like, no, Zach, just do you, you know, because again, he was picked for what he does, you know. And like, he's got an amazing voice, and his comic timing is really sharp. Like, he's really, it's quite incredible, actually. And he would go off his lines, like, a lot of the time. And I was really happy with that because, you know, I'm not American, and we'd written the script. Sometimes it was, you know, we'd like, how would you think he would say it? And he would kind of, like, just start riffing. And so, yeah, it didn't take long for him to kind of find his feet with that, yeah.
That's cool. I heard Guillermo del Toro
came
on to set. That must mean, tell me about that day, and what did you guys talk about? And just his Pinocchio, I freaking loved. Was he making that at the same time?
Yeah, no, he'd finished it. And so he was kind of doing a little bit of a tour, you know, to kind of like show the film to people and, you know, talk about it. And he, you know, there's a lot of people worked on Pinocchio that have worked at Aardman in the past. It's a stop motion community. And so it was just great that he came. And the thing about him is he's kind of like a big kid, you know, like he just loves making films, you know. He's not, I know he's a legend and like a brand in his own right. But when you meet him, he's just an enthusiastic big kid that just kind of loves. It's kind of like loving a train set, you know. So he would be in, he'd be like, oh, wow, you got that, look at that spiral staircase. And we'd be like, yeah, look at that, you know. And what about what about that? How did that puppet work that you had? And actually, his first film was a stop motion film. But I don't know if you know the story. Like, he's put a lot of time and care into making the stop motion film. But somebody broke into his studio and destroyed it. So his first film was this. So his first love is stop motion, actually. So yeah, it was great.
I've been lucky enough to meet Guillermo.
He's grand, isn't he? Yeah.
As we wrap up, You know, as I say, I love the OG Chicken Run. I love this. I want more. So I've got some potential titles.
Oh, great. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
You can back them in whatever fashion you see.
Yeah.
By the way, this is obviously Chicken Run 3, so I'm assuming that the E in Chicken Run is going to be 3. So just
there you are.
Just bear that. Nice.
Okay, here we go. Get in front of the studio.
Chicken Run 3, : The Great Escape.
Nice, like that. Yeah, like that. Yeah, I think we might have had that. Yeah, yeah.
Chicken Run, : The Empire Clocks Back.
That's great. That's great. So we're going to go sci-fi. We're going to go even more sci-fi with that one.
Magic is happening in this room. This is good. Okay. Chicken Run, : The Return of the Wing. Go all of the rings with it. I want to see that film. This is good.
Yeah.
Right. Chicken Run, : Foul Play.
Personally, my favorite,
here we go, Chicken Run,
:
Poultry in Motion.
Yes, Poultry in Motion. We've had that. We've been playing around with these puns forever, you know. Like, in a way, this is Chicken Impossible, actually, this movie. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What I'm
going to
say is, if you go with any one of those, I'm
10%. Well, yeah, no, indeed, yeah. No, that's quite fair enough, yeah. I like the... I like the Star Wars reference, you know, because it's always good with when Arben does a new genre, you know, like Were Rabbit did the horror and Farmageddon was the sci-fi.
You mentioned Star Wars. You guys just did the Star Wars short
film. Yeah. That's right. It's good to be involved in all these different things.
Cool.
Nice one.
Sam, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks for helping us get the film out there.
Chicken Run, : Poultry in Motion.
Right, okay, well, that was Chicken on Dawn and Nugget, which kind of works with our upcoming...
When the snowman brings the Christmas.
I don't know. I was kind of segueing and kind of like going into it. I don't know if it worked. So basically, Chicken Run, Donut Nugget, it's coming out now. It's like one of those films. Like, I feel like Wallace and Gromit, like Aardman stuff is stuff that you watch at Christmas, but they aren't necessarily, like The Wrong Trousers aren't necessarily a Christmas movie, but it's something you watch at Christmas. So I guess for us this year, we're going to come up with some films that are like non-Christmas technically, like they're great to watch at Christmas. And I think we've also put to bed like Die Hard is a Christmas movie. So I don't get why people are suggesting it's not a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
It's very clearly a Christmas movie. So we're talking about films that could have, you know, it could be set, I guess, you know, I'm not saying you would see it, but like the Huntsman, Winter's War. That's in winter. You could watch it at Christmas because there's snow. Therefore, there's a connection. Or like one that's not necessarily about it. There's a connection to the period. Or there's something that's kind of feels like this tonally, thematically suited to the season.
Yeah. Can I put, I'd be upfront and say Star Wars, because I think I have a recent nostalgia attachment to when they used to release a Star Wars movie every Christmas. I don't know why they stopped doing that, but that was really special. And so I feel like I now do sort of associate Star Wars with Christmas. And I feel like, if you have memories, maybe Lord of the Rings too, having memories of going during the winter season and the lead up to the holidays can make that movie a Christmas movie. And I would argue the same for Wonka, because that's out now.
I would say, and I think musicals are a really good shout.
Yes.
For this period. I like watching things like The King and I. You know, things like that. Because what's also, I guess there's always things that come on the TV that they obviously the broadcasters like buy the rights to or get the distribution deals in. I'd love to know like the battle each year about who gets certain films. Because obviously there must be a bidding war about who gets them. Like, I mean, it's obviously a Christmas film, but like I wonder who's getting Love Actually. Because you know everyone watches that film. So what are the films that they get that like a, I don't know, ones that suit... So there's a lot of ones that come on, like at the period, like the Seven Brothers for Seven Sisters, Carousel.
Yeah.
Seven Brothers for Seven Sisters, Carousel.
Sound of Music.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, that's a very, very Christmas period song. I guess it's just like a film. I guess it's because it's the song and dance of it all. Meet Me in St. Louis is actually...
Has Christmas.
Has Christmas in it and has that Christmas song. But it's not technically a Christmas film. Wizard of Oz is a good one.
Well, do they still show The Great Escape every Christmas? Because obviously that became a massive staple. But I haven't really heard people talking about it being shown anymore. But I presume somebody still shows it every year.
Mm.
And that, I would say, is not a... That movie doesn't make me feel Christmassy. It's quite sad. So I don't know. I don't know where people got that idea, but I guess that's a Christmas movie.
I also think, like, romantic epics are quite good at this period. Like, Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, so you could watch Faraway Downs, which I haven't seen yet.
Watership Down.
Yeah, animated. I feel like a lot of kids' movies, because there's not only the nostalgia, like memory association with maybe watching it at Christmas time, but also, you know, if we take away the religious aspect of Christmas, what is it? You know, it's a feeling of community, together, thankfulness. And I feel like any film that presents those qualities, which I think a lot of kids' family movies do, can quite easily feel Christmassy.
Yeah.
Paddington, the Paddington.
Also, movies. Consumerism, Toy Story.
Yeah.
I also think things like Field of Dreams, that's a really good film for Christmas.
Interesting. That to me is a summer movie.
It's a summer movie. I guess it's because it's this idea of, like, I think, God, not to quote like Love Actually, but there is the kind of thing about connecting with family that even at times and stuff when you might have fallen out or things aren't better, it's about reconnection with that family. And I guess Field of Dreams is literally him trying to, if you build it, they will come. And there's a kind of, like, I guess there's a religious element to it as well. It's kind of, there's a kind of like, biblical sign of you do the task and there's this kind of supernatural thing. And then he meets his father at the end of it, but he's also connecting with his daughter. And it's just that kind of, like, I don't know, I feel like the old, you know, the old American pastime with this kind of, I think there's something about it that has this quite, I think that really speaks to the kind of values of Christmas, I guess.
Yeah, okay. That's in, yeah.
You're like, and I wasn't going to watch it, but now I am.
Yeah, I think it's good. You made a good case. I guess any movie about Jesus, Ben-Hur.
Ben-Hur is a great one. Original, though, not the remakes.
Seen the remake.
Also, I was going to suggest, like, snow things. So maybe something like, is Gremlins a Christmas movie?
Gremlins is 100% a Christmas. That is literally a Christmas movie, though. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was thinking The Thing.
Yes, I think you could make that case.
Yeah, there's snow at Christmas. What was the one I kind of said? Vertical Limit.
I mean, Everest. Society of the Snow is coming out.
Oh yeah,
next week. We haven't reviewed it. We might be able to do it next.
Indeed, it comes out January 4th, though. So I think on Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah, so we might cover it then. I don't know if I would say that made me feel Christmassy, because it's quite horrifying to watch.
But then, like, I guess it's kind of like there's something, sometimes people don't want to watch traditionally.
True, because I love watching Gremlins at Christmas, and that's a really dark movie. I mean, her dad dies in the chimney.
Spoiler alert. Yeah, that is really dark.
Yeah.
Carol, is that one?
Carol, yeah, because that does have a Christmas scene in it. Mm. I would say people, and I've had this conversation before, people always say Night Before Christmas is a Halloween film, but it's a Christmas movie. Because he learns about the values of Christmas.
Yeah.
It's a Christmas film. He doesn't learn about the values of Halloween. Beetlejuice is
I feel like
movie.
Technically it is, it doesn't cover ours, because I do think it says Nightmare Before Christmas, therefore Christmas is in the title. So whether, it's kind of like, it is either, it's both a Halloween movie and a Christmas movie.
Mm.
Or,
it's more a Christmas movie.
Oh, very cool. I'll let you have it.
Thank you.
Oh, you know what also is a great, you know what I think about as well is like Homeward Bound.
Ah,
like yes. White Fang. Those are good, like Christmas, like epic adventures, I guess, as well, quite good for Christmas periods.
Thumbelina, Anastasia. I mean, the classics keep
Anastasia! Oh my god, that is a great Christmas movie, because it's like, not Christmas, but it's cold.
Winter and Russia. Russia's quite a Christmassy country.
Yeah. I think we've given quite a few there. There you go, listeners. Let us know what your non-Christmas Christmas movie's in. But for now, thanks for tuning in and happy viewing via whatever medium is safe for you. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It makes a difference. And tweet us any questions or hot takes or non-Christmas movies at Fade to Black Pod on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram and Letterboxd at Hannah and S. Flint.
And I'm at Clarice Lou on Twitter or at Clarice Lockery on Instagram.
Farewell, film friends. It's time to fade to black.